from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With 2 weeks to go until Iraq's January 30th elections, the situation in that country is grim. Today, gunmen kidnapped a Catholic archbishop in Mosul and killed at least 22 people in a series of brazen attacks. General George Casey, the top U.S. general in Iraq, is predicting more trouble and violence on Election Day. Even the White House is trying to lower expectations. All this while American troops in Iraq are under fire. Casualties are mounting, as are the risks for Iraqi voters and candidates. This hour, we're checking in on Iraq, on its shaky path to elections. We'll hear from reporters in Baghdad and from The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson, who recently sat down with interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Plus, we'll talk with one U.S. congressman who says it's time for Washington to announce a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Tonight on Point, Iraq, 2 weeks and counting until Election Day. I'm joined from Baghdad by Ed Wong of the New York Times. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
And by Ann Barnard of the Boston Globe. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Ed, let me go to you first. Before we get deeper into Iraq, you've just come into Baghdad from Jordan, where Iraqis there, as in a dozen countries around the world, are preparing to do absentee voting in the January 30th election. What kind of activity did you see among those voters outside the country?
Well, Jordan is one of the more active countries where they're trying to get Iraqis involved. It's because there are a lot of Iraqi expatriates in Jordan. So around Amman, you see these posters put up urging Iraqis to take part in the vote. Today, in all the 14 countries that are hosting expatriate voting, they started registration. So in certain cities in the U.S., I think there's around four or five cities in the U.S. that are hosting this, you'll see Iraqis coming to the registration centers and filling out the forms. They've got around 5 days to do so. And then the actual expatriate voting starts on January 28th, 2 days before the actual voting here in Iraq. So the countries where Iraqis are expected to eagerly take part in it are some of the ones where there are a lot of Iraqis, which include places like Iran, the U.S., and the U.K. And the expatriate voting organization that's setting this up has set up a call center where Iraqis from all over the world can call in and ask how they can take part. And they told me that they're hearing the most responses from Iraqis in the U.S. So it seems like Iraqis in the U.S. at least might be better informed about the possibility that they can vote than maybe some in other countries, even with large populations.
And Ed, let me ask you, what kind of numbers are we talking about? How big a portion of the overall ballot tally, voter turnout, could come from outside Iraq's borders?
The organizers are saying that the high end might be a million, and they are saying that that's a very high estimate. And right now in Iraq, the organizers of the Iraqi voting are saying that they're expecting a turnout here of 7 to 8 million. So if the optimistic estimates for out of country are correct, which is 1 million, then that could make a fairly significant portion of the votes.
Ann Barnard in Baghdad as well, take us into what's going on there. Very bloody body count again today in Iraq. We're seeing at least 22 dead policemen, soldiers, all over the country, in Sunni heartland in particular, but not only there, mortar attacks on polling stations in Basra and elsewhere. This is a very, very tough run-up, and we're still some days away from the vote.
Yeah, today's violence illustrates how these elections will probably be one of the toughest tests yet of the Iraqi security forces, which have been shaky pretty much all along. And every few months we hear about how there's going to be a renewed effort to train them and focus on quality instead of quantity. But the problem is these guys still are not sufficiently trained. We just heard a couple days ago from the U.S. commander up in Mosul, which has become the second most dangerous city after the Fallujah Ramadi area. And he said that the entire police force fled recently, and they now have only a fraction of the number of people that they need. So you're going to have more than 5,000 polling stations across the country, and it's very important for there to be a perception that the security is handled by Iraqis. But at the same time, British troops, American troops all over are making detailed plans for their quick reaction plans and their plans to guard polling stations because of the fact that no one can be sure that the Iraqi police would stand up in the face of an insurgent attack on polling centers.
Ann, I wish you'd take us into some of the numbers here. First of all, let's look at turnout, polling places, poll workers. First of all, with turnout, how many potential Iraqi voters are there? How many are U.S. and Iraqi officials saying they expect to actually go to the polls and cast a vote?
Well, turnout is a very sensitive issue because the Sunni minority, which lost much of the influence that it held under Saddam Hussein and is behind much of the insurgency that's going on in the country, the leaders have threatened to boycott the vote, and these are also the areas with the most violence and therefore where voters might be most intimidated. So there's a question that there could be very low turnout in Sunni areas, which would raise an issue of ethnic tensions after the vote if the Sunnis feel like they're not properly represented. As far as how many total voters there are, nobody really knows. There's estimated to be 14 million eligible adults to vote, but because the voter registration process was not a conventional registration where each voter comes and registers individually, we don't know the exact numbers. Instead, they took a database that Saddam Hussein had used to give food rations to every citizen, and people were given a certain amount of time to come in and correct their data if it was incorrect. So approximately 4 million people either came to add themselves to the list or to correct their information. So we have no idea whether that means that there's a high level of interest or a low level of interest, because we don't know how many mistakes and missing people there were in the database.
And what about the number of polling stations? You've reported that there were supposed to be 7,000 to 9,000 polling places. In fact, there will only be about 5,500. Why so many fewer than planned?
We're being told by Western diplomats that the reason really is because it's just too difficult to secure the higher number of polling stations. In public, Iraqi authorities are saying this is just the amount that we need. We don't need as many as we thought. But it's clear that it's a security issue. There's not enough personnel to guard so many polling stations. This, of course, raises another issue about turnout, because this means the polling stations will be clustered closer together, or that people will have to travel farther to get to their nearest polling station. Another of the security measures that they've discussed is banning traffic on major roads, and they're even considering a total traffic ban. So with fewer polling stations, it's more of a challenge to get everybody to the ballot box.
And this would be a traffic ban on voting day to keep suicide bombers from driving explosives near the polling stations, or more than just voting day?
They've said it will be 3 days, perhaps the day before, the day of, and the day after.
And what about poll workers? And you've also reported that 150,000 were said to be needed. They've only hired 6,000 so far. Where does that stand?
Well, that is what we were told about a week ago, although that is not necessarily as bad as it sounds, because it's a pyramid-shaped training model where you train the trainers, and then each of those people goes out and trains the people that they need for their polling station. So that training is ongoing, according to the top UN official advising the Election Commission. But the question is, how well-trained will the people at the bottom of the pyramid be, particularly in an atmosphere where poll workers are very frightened of being seen in public, of gathering, of talking? So I don't know if they'll be able to go to enough training sessions to really understand how to run an election for the first time in decades. They do say that process is underway.
Ed Wong, can you describe for us exactly what Iraqis will be voting for? When they get into position to vote, what options are they going to be looking at?
Well, there's a list of various parties with slates of candidates, basically coalitions of parties with lots of candidate names that they'll vote for. But because of the security situation, a lot of the candidates actually haven't revealed their names yet. So right now, Iraqis might know what parties are running, but they have no idea who many of the candidates are who are representing these parties, which has become sort of a subject of some controversy and debate, because it raises the question of, in a democracy, shouldn't you know who you're voting for and at least have public debate about the platforms? But that hasn't been going on here, really, and there's been no real public campaigning. There's been some banners up. What they will vote for is, they will vote for, basically, each person gets one vote, and they're voting to put people into a National Assembly of 275 seats that will then write a constitution. They'll have 1 year to write a constitution, and it will also install an executive government for that year, a prime minister and other executives who will run the country for that year.
Ann Barnard, I'm seeing here a couple of American congresswomen quoted. Judy Biggert, Republican from Illinois, she's just been talking with Iraqis in Jordan. She says, "We heard it was a war zone, but didn't realize how dangerous it is." Ellen Tauscher, Democrat from California, describing the election process in Iraq as surreal. How are Iraqis talking about it? I mean, I realize there's many different views depending if you're Sunni or Shiite, but they're all facing dangerous voting if they intend to do it at all.
I think one of the candidates that those congressmen women met with is Salama Khafaji, who I interviewed a few days ago. And just this morning, she survived the third assassination attempt on her since she's been in public life for about the past year. And in a previous attack on her, her 17-year-old son was killed. So this is what anybody faces who attempts to participate in the political process. And for individual, regular people, the discussion among our Iraqi staff here and all the Iraqis we talk to is whether or not they're even going to go to vote. They're afraid to go. They're concerned that if they're seen voting, people in their neighborhood will remember and they could be targeted. Another concern is that polling stations may be mortared. So we just heard that in some neighborhoods, people are moving out of their houses if they live close to a polling station. At the same time, there is a lot of discussion going on, and it's interesting to hear among the Shiite majority, people discussing what kind of Shiite-dominated government would they like to have. Would they like it to be Islamist, or would they like it to be secular? And a lot of secular Iraqis are thinking about voting for Prime Minister Alawi, even though he had little public support when he was installed with the backing of the U.S., because they see him as the only well-known alternative to the clerics that are dominating the Shiite party that's expected to get the most votes. So there is discussion about these issues, but I think the biggest practical issue for most voters is whether or not they feel safe to vote, and that's a big open question in a lot of people's minds.
Ed, Ann reports a State Department poll indicating 89% of Shiites call themselves likely voters, 40% of Sunnis. Of course, those numbers can change drastically given the security situation. But what's your sense of the best possible outcome or impact of this election and the worst or less attractive outcomes?
Well, the best possible outcome would be if those who voted for the election and even those who didn't accepted the results as a legitimate result and that the government was able to move forward and actually put into practice its policies and agree on people who can run the country. I don't think anyone really thinks that the insurgency will quiet down after the election. I think that the people who are carrying on the campaign right now are probably going to be just as opposed to whatever government gets elected as if there were no elections held or against the Lavi's government or the U.S. But whether the insurgency will get larger is the question. And in a worst-case scenario would be that a lot of the Sunni Arabs who boycott the election or who decide that there are no candidates representing them feel that the Shiite-dominated government is an illegitimate government or does not represent them in any way. And then they, in fact, will take up arms or will join the insurgency, and that will add to more violence.
And, Anne, we've just got a minute left here, but what's your sense? Is there any way, given the security situation in the Sunni zone of Iraq, Sunni zones, that Iraq could come out of this election with a result that all these different groups could build a consensus around in spite of the insurgency? Is there a way this could be a first step toward some greater calm there?
Well, if you just look at what the religious leaders were saying in the mosques on Friday, it's hard to find a unified vision of this election. The Sunni clerics in Fallujah and Ramadi and the rest of Al-Anbar province were telling their congregations that they're under a religious order not to vote. They said, you must not go and vote. We don't want to be fooled twice by the occupiers, referring to feeling that the new government installed in June did not make any good changes. Whereas in a Shiite mosque in Baghdad, the imam told the worshipers that if they do not vote for the Shiite candidates who have the support of the main Shiite cleric in Iraq, they'll have to answer for it on Judgment Day. So those are pretty divergent views about the election.
So there it is, straight from the House of God. Looks like a rough path ahead. Ann Barnard, always great talking with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ann Barnard with the Boston Globe. And Ed Wong with the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
After a break, The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson joins us to talk about his one-on-one interviews with Iraqi interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq and its fast-approaching election, 2 weeks and counting now. Insurgents bent on sabotaging the elections have stepped up the violence, raising concerns for the safety of voters, candidates, troops on the ground, and the future of the country. Still, the vote is going ahead. The stakes are especially high for Iraq's interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. The U.S. installed Alawi as the country's interim leader in June, and there have been many unanswered questions about his past and political aspirations ever since. John Lee Anderson is a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. He recently sat down for several one-on-one interviews with Prime Minister Alawi. John Lee Anderson left Baghdad yesterday. We caught up with him in Amman, Jordan. I asked him if Alawi seems nervous as the election nears.
On the contrary, over the course of the last couple of weeks, up to a couple of days ago when I last saw him, I was observing him and trying to find a chink in his armor. He's a man who's festooned with defenses, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. He hides himself well. But I finally realized in our last meeting that the one sort of epiphany I felt I had was that he felt comfortable with power. He already wears it like an old shoe, and I commented on this. And I have to say, it was the one time I felt that he tried to fend it off, but I insisted, and he finally warmed to the theme and more or less confirmed my hunch, which was that he is a man comfortable with power. He certainly doesn't and didn't, in his response to me, sound like a man who was afraid of losing it. He behaves quite confidently. I asked him also what he would do if he failed in the current elections. That was failed to be selected as leader again, depending on the outcome of the upcoming elections. And he didn't want to get into specifics, but he said he was going to continue to be active politically. So I think this is a man who has, you know, in a sense, spent 30 years conspiring against Saddam, and then by fluke, by luck, by fate, has been sworn in as a prime minister, but sees himself as still fighting the same battle. It's the regime that he is now fighting against that's gone underground, and he happens to be in Baghdad and believes that this is still part of an ongoing struggle. And to a large extent, is still a man who is conspiring and battling against the same old enemy. He just happens to be in the public eye now. And the same people that were backing him when he was out of power in exile are backing him now.
That is, the Americans were backing him then and backing him now.
The Americans, that's right. The Americans and the British.
John Lee Anderson, this is a man who is no stranger to power or to foreign support. He was a Ba'athist in the old days, supported by the CIA during his many years of exile in London. Since he's come back and been in power in Iraq, of course, rumored to have straight up shot prisoners at a Baghdad police station. He denies that. How does Iyad Alawi present? You describe him as a tall, bulky man, large, balding head, lumbering gait of an old prize fighter. Is this a strong man in the making, or is this a Democrat, small d?
I think he's a man that's still evolving. I don't think we've yet seen the full Iyad Alawi. And that's, I think, what I was getting at when I said that I think he still feels himself to be a man attaining power. He's still fighting the regime that is threatening to unseat the whole American enterprise and the enterprise he's involved with, which is the stabilization of post-Saddam Iraq. And to a large extent, he is a man who is still becoming known to us. The story you mentioned where he, you know, allegedly executed prisoners. I happened to speak to a witness, an eyewitness of this, or I should say alleged eyewitness of this incident. But I have to say, in all my years as a reporter, which are now mounting, I came away believing that the man was a credible witness. And when I asked, whenever Iyad Alawi has been asked about this incident or others in which he's accused of having used brutality or violence, he denies it in a pro forma way, and then, as if he can't help himself, adds, almost undercutting his denial, a kind of addendum in which he, for instance, when I asked him the other day, have you ever killed anybody? No, never. Have you ever tortured anybody? No. Pause. But I have ordered the police to kill terrorists, and then going off on a long riff about how a firm hand is needed to deal with terrorists, otherwise they will destroy society. He has a very strong worldview about this. Even Ambassador Negroponte commented on it to me in our interview, in which he pointed out how, although, you know, Iyad Alawi, whom he likes, talks a great deal about democracy and he believes he wants to be a Democrat, he had noted that he is very obsessed with building a strong army for Iraq and asked me if I had also noticed that, which I did. Indeed, Iyad Alawi called it his crusade to me. So he is a man who will be small d Democrat, yes, and very much a strong man from the Western perspective.
So for this innately strong man, what is at stake in the elections coming up on January 30th? He may or may not be elected. He's, of course, just interim prime minister. This new transitional National Assembly will choose a new prime minister. It may or may not be him. What's at stake for Iyad Alawi in the vote?
I suppose it is his political future. It's pretty clear that the Americans and the British feel comfortable with him. All of the Iraqi players, and I would say a great deal of the potential electorate, also understand that. They're also aware that, to a large extent, to the degree that Iraq is stable or can remain stable, depends upon a continued improvement of and the goodwill of the presence of the Americans and the British in Iraq, if you know what I mean. Iyad Alawi is perceived as their choice for this stabilization period. He's a secular Shia, which means that he comes from the demographic majority of the country, but is not worryingly religious, as are some of the other candidates, including those on the ticket, which is likely to win a plurality.
What do you mean he's not worrying the religious? We heard earlier that secular Iraqis may vote for him, even though they're not wild about him, just because they see him as possibly a bulwark against an Islamic state in Iraq. But how do the more religious Iraqis look on Iyad Alawi?
Well, it's interesting. They tend to hold their own counsel. Certainly the religious Sunnis anti-coalition Sunnis, and by and large, most Sunnis feel marginalized and alienated from this entire process, regard him as a CIA stooge, as a traitor, as a coward. In fact, this evening here in Jordan, I had a meeting with several sheikhs from the Ramadi Fallujah area who clearly regard him as something shootable. But the religious Shia, and there are many, they are regarded by most observers, and that's the sort of zeitgeist, that they will win a plurality. Now, and when I said worryingly religious, referring to them as worryingly religious, I'm sort of relaying what I pick up to be the mind frame of the Americans and the metropolitan Iraqis, who are concerned about a possibly Iranian-backed religious Shiite government taking place. Now, I asked one of the main candidates of the religious Shiite, on the religious Shiite slate, Abdelaziz al-Hakim, strongest party, in fact, and he's the number one candidate on the list blessed by Ayatollah Sistani, what would happen if he felt that by assuming a post, let's say the prime ministership, assuming his party won a plurality, even if it was his right, would he do it if he felt that it, on the one hand, alienated the Americans, and on the other hand, inflamed the Sunnis further? And instead of answering me, he looked at me and said, "What do you think I should do?" Never gave me a response. I came away feeling that he had yet to decide what he should do. But around him, within the sort of religious Shiite community, there is a kind of growing consensus that they may have to horse trade. And if, for the short term, that is the next 6 months up to the writing of the Constitution and then the following 6 months to the next election, they might well, in exchange for, say, more power in ministries, go ahead and let a consensus candidate, someone like Alawi, continue in office. I think there's a great many Iraqis who would like to see continuity. It comes hand in hand with security and stabilization, which things which Iyad Alawi is certainly promising, even if he hasn't been able to deliver.
John Lee Anderson, let me ask you. You quote a prominent Iraqi politician, unnamed, saying that Americans have quietly let the leading candidates know that there are three conditions they are expecting the next Iraqi government to meet. One, that the country should not be under the influence of Iran. Two, that it should not ask for the withdrawal of American troops. Three, that it should not install an Islamic State. Now, these elections are being portrayed to the world as the moment when Iraq becomes independent, that it's no longer a transitional government. It has ideally the legitimacy of an Iraqi vote behind it. And yet these are very large conditions. If this politician you quote is correct, that would seem to say, no, it's still the U.S. in charge, in effect.
Well, I mean, you know, no one can conceal the fact that there are 150,000 American troops in the country. The United States has an extraordinary presence in this country, and I mean, to a degree, the political opening we're seeing taking place, this political theater, and I don't mean that in a tendentious way.
Mm-hmm.
There is a legitimacy to the fact that there are now politicians, homegrown, former exiles and others, people that didn't have a voice in this country, now expressing themselves, horse trading, people who were enemies for years, now getting into pragmatic alliances. The game of politics has begun, which is, it resonates with the kind of politics we know, but it's taking place upon an abnormal stage, a stage in which there is an insurgency that is extremely violent and fathomless yet to all of us, in the sense that we don't know how strong it is, how widely based, how much more violent it will become. And there is the other abnormality is, of course, that our fellow citizens are there in a huge number, and most of them in uniform and fighting a war. So under those conditions, of course, there isn't true sovereignty yet in Iraq, although there Nor can this be a fully, a fully representative election. It is altered circumstances, and I think whatever is said publicly in terms of idealized rhetoric about it, this is a highly vitiated experience we're watching, and not one in which most Iraqis, I think, feel that they are entirely independent. No.
You just described the insurgency there as, in many respects, unfathomable. You said earlier that the Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, sees himself as fighting the same old fight, the same old enemy, by which I took you to mean allies of Saddam Hussein. So which is it? Is it the old Ba'athist? Is it a new and unfathomable insurgency, some hybrid?
Well, I mean, I don't mean to be too facile by saying that's a $60,000 question, but, you listen to someone like Iyad Alawi, and he's very clear on who the enemy is. This is the Ancien regime that melted away as the American troops seized the cities of Iraq. And then, having either cut deals or subsequently cut deals with Islamists to bring in suicide bombers and jihadis, have waged war with the liberation forces, including former opposition politicians like himself, ever since. Through the 8 months that Saddam was out of power, in hiding, once he'd fallen from power, and since his arrest. And what he tends to exclude from that is that there is also a culture of resistance, which is undeniable, and this is coming from me, that has grown up as a result of the American presence, in particular in the Sunni areas, but we also saw it amongst some of the Shiites when Muqtada al-Sadr had his uprising, on-off-again uprising, now quiescent, since the summer. But there is no doubt that, the presence of foreign forces however you want to describe the however you want to ascribe the causes of the violence to American mistakes or misrepresentations or cultural ineptitudes, there is no doubt amongst an unfathomable, unquantifiable, I should say, percentage of the Iraqi population mostly amongst the Sunna, who were disenfranchised when Saddam fell from power, a hostility and animosity, and therefore a culture of resistance towards the American occupation. Now, that doesn't mean that all of them are fighting with guns, but it's a mixed bag, and there is no doubt that there are also a former, as they like to call them, former regime elements. But people who were in the army, there was many hundreds of thousands who were simply thrown out of work. These people had nowhere else to go. And there were obviously people who, the regime melted away. They waited and watched, and they organized. So you have a kind of hybrid grab bag, which even American intelligence and the American commanders in Iraq admit that they don't fully comprehend or understand.
And if Alawi...
That's why it's unfathomable.
And what does Alawi imagine if things come to pieces? The civil war path or some kind of return to a Sunni-dominated Saddam-style dictatorship?
He doesn't contemplate the worst coming to pass. He sees, he's a man without doubts, I think, in the sense that he believes that now that America's there and there is a plan and there's an army, at least a titular Iraqi army under his aegis, building and increasing in strength every month, the enterprise will ultimately prevail. But that ultimately what they want to achieve is a kind of continuation of the terrorist state. I would say this view of his is shared also by a large number of the other Shiite politicians, including religious ones. They see, Saddam state as having been a terrorist state, and that's what the insurgency is. It's the terrorist state having gone underground. And they're determined to fight it now from a position of strength, whereas before they fought it from a position of weakness. So in that sense, Iyad Alawi is a pragmatic, could well become, and these are things that are taking place sort of behind the curtains. But there are talks, there are lines of communication between him and some of his political rivals. And if they all believe that a pragmatic alliance is the best thing to continue to maintain the upper hand against their enemies, this former terrorist regime, this sort of sectarian, subversives, people trying to stir the pot to create a civil war, that they will, they will remain in a fraternity with one another so as to prevent that from happening.
I'm talking with John Lee Anderson, correspondent for The New Yorker. His article in this week's edition is A Man of the Shadows, that is, Iraq's Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with correspondent John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker magazine. He's in Amman, Jordan tonight. He's spent a lot of time recently with the Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. His article in this week's New Yorker is A Man of the Shadows. John Lee Anderson, you describe a meeting that you attended where the Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has got, 100, 200 sheikhs in a big conference hall. In the middle of this, the doors open, and in come the American ambassador, John Negroponte, along with five U.S. senators. Bill Frist, a Republican majority leader of Tennessee, of course, Majority Whip Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Norm Coleman of Minnesota, Mike DeWine of Ohio, and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, the only Democrat, the only woman in the room. That must have been quite a moment. What was the dynamic of the relationship between these American politicians suddenly dropping in on this big meeting and the Iraqis there with the Alawi?
Yes, it was quite an interesting scene. The American senators sat down on couches facing the room where the sheikhs were sitting. I was sitting amongst them. This American senator sat down quite deferentially alongside him and facing the sheikhs. Iyad Alawi explained to the sheikhs whom they were and invited those who wanted to rise to their feet and tell the American senators their points of view and their grievances. And several of them did so standing up, giving just, I can only call it a kind of phantasmagoria of the various sides of the Iraqi problem. One man from Mosul stood up, and what I remember him saying was that the problem with Mosul isn't the American occupation, it's the Kurdish occupation of Mosul. We must end the Kurdish occupation. Another man stood up and spoke about the need for American troops to behave better, for compensation to be paid for victims of American misbehavior, and that the Americans should leave Iraq. And their demeanor was respectful, but their words were strong, and they almost unanimously said that the election should be postponed. They didn't agree with it. These were Sunni sheikhs, and that's a kind of consensual point of view amongst most of the Sunni political leadership. And then Mr. Alawi thought that that was enough. They sat down again, and the senators, I remember them sort of listening with frozen smiles to all of this. And then Bill Frist gave a speech, which was straight out of the American Senate, after this rather shambolic volley of opinions that hit them by the Sunni sheikhs. He compared what he had just witnessed to the U.S. Senate, where he said, we share emotions and give our opinions every day, and he lauded them for that. And he explained that he and the others represented 270 million Americans. And I have to say, sitting amongst the sheikhs, it sounded just a speck patronizing. What was the most interesting of all, or revealing, was that he got a very... normally Iraqis are very fulsome in their public display of respect. In this case, none stood when he had finished, and only about 20 to 25 of the 110 men there actually clapped. And then they simply left very quickly, and that was it. It was over. And it went back to being an Iraqi meeting between the Alawi and the Sheikh.
Some voices in the U.S. are now not President Bush, but others are beginning to call for the withdrawal or radical drawdown of U.S. troops. And they're downplaying as well, the Bush administration is downplaying the importance of this January election itself, saying not everything hinges on this. How do you think Alawi sees the election, the importance of it, and what if U.S. troops were to begin to be significantly drawn down in the months, let's say the 12 months, 18 months after the election?
I did speak to him about the whole issue of American troops, and he said, that of course American troops must leave one day. But he made it clear that he saw them as essential, that he saw them as an essential partner, and that he would like to see them ultimately replaced by NATO troops. That there was no question that he wanted to see continued international troop involvement in Iraq for, it sounded like, many years to come, and he thought that that would be necessary. I questioned Ambassador Negroponte about the same issue, these news reports you're referring to. And he downplayed them in my conversation. I got the impression that he did not agree with the notion of withdrawing American troops. I must say, having just come from Baghdad yesterday, I find it almost inconceivable that having put themselves in this predicament, where American troops are essentially only in control of the bases that they literally sit in, and even there get rocketed, and in the very entrances to those bases, including the Green Zone, car bombs go off every other day, rockets go in, and they are basically on permanent lockdown and have to chopper to and from bases, that they would contemplate pulling them out, leaving the country to what would likely be mayhem. The incipient Iraqi armed forces that they're pulling together are far from capable of actually standing on their own with these very ideological, in some cases, very, very motivated insurgents.
And so everything still just that fluid as we come to these elections. John Lee Anderson, tonight in Amman, Jordan. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for your report.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
John Lee Anderson is a correspondent with The New Yorker. His article, A Man of the Shadows, appears in this week's issue. He spoke with me from Amman, Jordan. And finally tonight, we turn to one politician's plan to get U.S. troops out of Iraq. Congressman Marty Meehan represents Massachusetts' 5th District. He's a senior Democratic member of the House Armed Services Committee. He returned Saturday from a fact-finding tour of Iraq and is now pushing a firm withdrawal timetable for U.S. troops. I asked Congressman Meehan exactly what he is proposing.
First of all, the last time I was in Iraq was in August of 2003, and it was hardly a stable place. But I could walk the streets, talk with average Iraqis, and that's something I had hoped to do this time. Unfortunately, the threat of violence was simply too high.
You couldn't even sleep overnight in Iraq.
That's right. We had to sleep in Jordan. So essentially, 2 years into the occupation, I think that we're going in the wrong direction. I mean, despite the spending more money and sending more money to Iraq, more soldiers to Iraq, we're seeing more violence. And my trip to Iraq has reinforced a conclusion that I've come to over many months, that our current policy in Iraq is failing. Now, it seems to me that we are left with three principal choices, and two of them really aren't options at all. Number one is to withdraw immediately. I don't believe that's a viable option, given the current state of the Iraqi security forces. The second option is to stay on the same path, as the president says, for as long as it takes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that this course of action will only cause the problem to grow worse. I'm proposing a third option, and that is that President Bush, Prime Minister Alawi, would announce a timetable for a phased-in drawdown of our forces in Iraq.
Drawn how far down by when, Congressman?
Well, I'm proposing the United States begin the process of drawing down to the majority of our forces by the end of this year, or certainly by the summer of 2006. That would be 12 to 18 months where we could change the dynamic in Iraq. We could transfer the handling of security to Iraqis, and I think 12 to 18 months is enough time to continue the process of training security forces. But also, I think it's important because it would help win the support of the Iraqi people for a political process and a government that is untainted by the appearance that we're controlling them.
Let me ask you exactly what you mean. We have about 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq now. Are you saying the majority would be out? That could leave, though, nearly, what, 75,000 troops there?
I would think that after 18 months, we could be down to a force of somewhere around 25,000 troops. But what it would do, I think it would send a clear message that we don't intend to occupy Iraq. I think it would splinter the insurgent groups who really have set aside their own differences to unite against the United States. I also think that it would encourage Iraqi government and factions within Iraq to deal with each other rather than solely relying on us for all the security.
Put in plain terms why you think that would work. And I note, it's not down to zero. It's down to 25,000, a lot less than now, but still a substantial force. Why would the reduction of U.S. forces to 25,000 in Iraq over the next year and a half encourage Iraqis to get their country on a different track?
Because it would send the message that we're not going to be an occupying force. Any country where there's an insurgency, if the occupying power is opposed to, and in this case, even our own State Department polls show that 70 to 80% of Iraqis don't want us to be occupying the country. That just fuels the insurgency. So the fact that we're occupying the country so visibly with 150,000 troops takes away our ability to fight the insurgency. It also takes away our ability to be able to set up a system of governance that isn't tainted by the view that we're controlling their government. What we need to do in Iraq is complete the training of Iraqi security forces. We also need to make a long-term commitment to Iraq in the form of reconstruction assistance. But we need to make it clear that our intention in Iraq is to leave. And the sooner we change the course in Iraq, I think the better it's going to be for our ability to achieve our goal and our mission there.
You're assuming that if Iraqis believe most U.S. forces are leaving, that they'll work out some kind of accommodation with one another instead of each going for the other's jugular, instead of civil war. Why do you make that assumption?
First and foremost, I make an assumption that in 18 months, we can train an Iraqi police force and we can train Iraqi soldiers. The most effective people to keep the peace and security should be a trained Iraqi security force.
That hasn't happened over the last 18 months or 2 years.
No, it hasn't, because the administration didn't focus on training
security forces. It wasn't until General Petraeus was put in charge of training Iraqi security forces in June did we begin this process. One of the many failures of the Bush administration in Iraq was not making the training of security forces a priority until a full year into the occupation.
But let me ask you something. Now Petraeus has been there working on that for a long time, and still, under attack, these forces tend to dissolve. Are you suggesting that even if, because at this point the evidence is not good for building that force, that even if it weren't built up to real strength, American forces should go anyway?
I think that we need to send that message. If we can't, 2 years into the insurgency, if we can't train enough people to keep the police, I mean, the truth here is that General Petraeus has been in Iraq. He's only been in charge of training Iraqi security forces since June. I watched the Iraqis being trained. I'm impressed with the progress that we're making. We need to devote our resources to the training program to emphasize quality over quantity. We need special forces that have the intelligence capabilities. And we need to make sure we don't train them for 2 weeks and send them on the streets. It's a 16-week process to train these Iraqi security forces.
But if the U.S. draws its forces down to 25,000, are you sure that Iraqis would see that as the end of occupation? Is Washington going to be able to leave even that many troops there? And if there were 25,000 troops there, what would they be doing if not occupying the country, if not dispersed around the country?
Well, if you look into the future, we're going to have to provide some assistance in terms of intelligence, in terms of training for Iraqi forces for some time to come. I don't think it's realistic to think that there would be no military presence whatsoever in Iraq. But what we need to do is get American forces into the background and put a trained security, Iraqi security forces up front, policing, doing the work with soldiers. There have been a lot of mistakes made here. We should have vetted the Iraqi army so that we had a force right from the beginning. We didn't do that, so it limits our options now. But
do you think the Bush administration is going to come around to your way of looking at things, Marty Meehan, after the election, perhaps?
I don't believe the administration has any choice but to pursue this path. And I think in the long run, it's the only way that we can have an exit strategy where the American people see light at the end of the tunnel. This war is costing the United States $1.5 billion a week right now. The cost of this war is only going to increase. The American people need to see light at the end of the tunnel, and we need to have the Iraqi people to understand it's going to be up to them to get the training and the skills they need to keep their country secure and safe.
If we see a drawdown to 25,000 U.S. troops and Iraq is in a raging civil war, what does the U.S. do then? Build the troops back up again, pull out entirely?
Well, we need to do our job training. Look, this is not a sure thing. No one has a plan that's a sure thing. None of these situations are. But what I know is in any country in the world where there's an insurgency, if the occupying country doesn't have the support of the people, then the insurgency simply grows. This notion that we're going to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people at this point is a notion that shouldn't be our goal. What our goal should be is to set up a system of governance. The UN Security Council resolution that we're operating under already has set a timetable. January 30th for elections, the end of October for a constitution, and then second elections by the end of 2005. Surely by August of 2006, the majority of our forces should be out of Iraq and let the Iraqi people run their country.
Congressman Marty Meehan saying it's time for light at the end of the tunnel. Congressman Meehan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Democratic Congressman Martin Meehan represents Massachusetts' 5th District. He spoke with me from Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.